Welcome to Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman, serial entrepreneur, author, and podcast host. Whether success for you is more money, time with your family, a healthy, well-balanced life, or freedom, I'm interviewing guests and getting you the advice to make it happen. So join me as we uncomplicate the complicated, help you define success, and give you the strategies to make it happen. Hello, and welcome back to Success Is, the podcast where we explore different paths to achievement. I'm Phil Portman, and today I'm joined by Pat Ahern, Managing Partner at Intergrowth. Pat's team help B2C businesses to acquire more customers through powerful SEO, content marketing, and meta ads. Based in Stockholm, Pat brings both business insight and adventurous energy to the show, from scaling companies to climbing volcanoes. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Phil, thank you for having me on. I can't wait to jump in today.
So let's kick it off with, what does success mean to you?
So to me, success is finding the perfect long-term balance between family, work, friends, and health. And I define those as work. I'm going to define it as family. I'm going to define it as health, sleep.
Yeah, I couldn't. Sleep, to me, it's like one of the most important things, and people don't realize that, because you have this like hustle and grind mentality out there that, yeah, you'll sleep when you're dead. But it is so important to, I mean, your mental capacity throughout the day, creative thinking, higher level thinking, longevity in life, relationships, and it is such an ignored thing. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Oh, definitely. And I think, I mean, this was my personal experience. I know a lot of other people who have gone through the same, but I think that I would argue most ambitious people, most people that would maybe label themselves as really ambitious, go through some phase of their lives where they're really adamant that they don't actually need sleep. For me, it was like my first, second year of college when I was determined to run on 3 to 5 hours of sleep a night. Your body can do that short term, and then long term, it beats you up. And I don't think you ever fully recover from that.
So I want to talk about Stockholm, because you're obviously not native to there, but that's currently where you're at. Can you walk us through the journey and how you ended up over there?
Yeah. I was going to say, what gives it away? Is it the subtle Boston accent that comes into play? No, but so for me, my experience in Stockholm really started out in 2014 when I studied abroad in a city called Uppsala. Really what it came down to is, loved my time in Stockholm. You know, I always joke that I made two rules for myself when I was out here, one of which was not to get in a relationship. About 2 weeks into being here, I met someone really important to me and broke that rule pretty much right away. So fast forward 11 years later, I guess it is, I'm now married to that woman that I met when I was studying abroad here. So long and short of it, we had many years of dating long distance. She moved to the US for a couple of years on visas. More recently, I guess it was like 4 years ago, I moved to Sweden on a visa, got accepted, and we got married pretty shortly after that.
That's awesome. What does your family think about this? You know, both that side of things and then the business side of things. And, you know, I heard, especially from a lot of like entrepreneurs, that it's difficult getting their family to understand what they're doing. And I would assume moving out of country and then all the things you're doing, you gotta have had some family members go, hey, are you sure about this? You know, have you experienced any of that?
So I've actually been really fortunate in that sense. I think the only family member that was truly bothered was my Mamie, I'll call her, my dad's mother, who I think, coming from her background, she was very uncomfortable with the fact that my wife and I lived together for several years before we were married. I think that got under her skin a little bit, but she's fine. She got over it. We have a great relationship. No, for my parents, they're actually psyched that I'm over here. And funny enough, two of my three siblings have spent quite a bit of time in the past couple of years actually living outside of the US as well. My sister was just in the Dominican Republic working there for, I think it was about a year, year and a half. My brother's been in Madrid for the past, call it 12 months. He'll be there for another, I think it's about 8 months, maybe 10 months that he's going to be over there. And then one of my other sisters is in DC, but I would say I come from a family that is very open-minded. My parents love to travel, and I think that me being abroad, a couple of my siblings being abroad, gives them some really good excuses to go about and go travel. And nowadays, you know, especially having a 15-month-old son, I think more than anything, it gives them this really great reason to come over to Stockholm, you know, at least once, maybe twice a year, so that they can get to, I think more so they can get to see my son Oliver than me nowadays. But long and short of it, I'm really, really grateful for that. You know, I come from parents that are very open-minded. They've always had this mindset of, you know, working hard is more important than getting really good grades. And I think a lot of that open-mindedness, a lot of that value placed on effort and let's call it working for what you care about is a value that was instilled on me very early on in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Stockholm's not that far from Boston. I mean, not flight wise, right? I mean, that's not, you pop over, you think about it, it's not much farther than like California or something like that, kind of in the opposite direction. So in the grand scheme, definitely, it's that bad. Has living there kind of changed your perspective on things at all or changed you at all? I know traveling around the world and meeting with different cultures, they have different ways of doing things, different ways of approaching business, relationships, and interactions. Are there any of those things that have influenced you or changed you over the years?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think there's a couple core areas that my mindset has really shifted on. One thing that's been really eye-opening for me, and for context, this is a big reason that I chose to study abroad in Stockholm to begin with, is from pretty, I would say like midpoint of high school, I was really interested in kind of the mixture of entrepreneurship and finding a way to do something that's going to make the world a slightly better place. So economics became a subject matter that I was very interested in. Social entrepreneurship, another really big passion point of mine. And pretty early in college, I decided that one of the themes I was really interested in exploring throughout my life was this idea of how do you find the right balance between creating equality in an economic system while also still having an incentive for people to build, for people to create new things. It's like that master economic question of, hey, if you have more income inequality, you tend to have a much larger GDP or a much larger pie is the broad term they'll use for it. If you have greater income equality, you tend to have a smaller overall pie, but everyone has their needs met. So there's this question that I always asked of like, how do you find that perfect balance in the pie? How do you determine the best way to divvy things up so that people are taken care of, but also that there's enough of an incentive to build and to create new things and to work hard that the society moves forward and that you end up building? For me, Sweden was so interesting because from my really limited research in it before I decided to study abroad there, it struck me as this system where there were a lot of social safety nets in place, but it was still a very entrepreneurial society. So I studied abroad here thinking, I really want to understand what social safety nets do they have in place and how does that impact day-to-day life? I would say Sweden is much more, and I want to bring this up in a way that's not going to touch on politics. So
he'll cut me off
if you think we dangle too close there, but I just want to share my perspective on it, that Sweden is a place where higher education is, I'm going to say, more or less free. There are cases where maybe you would take out loans to cover, let's say, like your cost of living. But the actual education itself, if you're a Swedish citizen or if you have permanent residence, totally free. Two, you can also get really low interest rate loans if you are a student up to a certain amount so that you can cover your cost of living without having yourself go into extreme debt and take on this extreme interest rates in order to do so. Childcare isn't free, but it's very, very heavily subsidized by the government. You know, in the US, I have friends that are paying $2,000 to $3,000 US per month for childcare for their single child. My wife and I are spending, I think it's around 200 US per month for our son to be in daycare right now. You know, certainly not free, but that's pretty heavily subsidized by the government. Sweden has a lot of job security. So if you lose your job, there's a lot of elements that go into play behind the scenes to A, ensure your income is covered as long as you are doing baseline tasks to search for a job, to do job training, things of that sort. The other thing that comes into play on the inverse side of things, though, Sweden has really high taxes. So I'm going to work just with some really rough benchmarks. Colorado is where I have the most working experience in the US. That's where I was based after college for, I think it was 6 years that I was in Colorado. Ballpark, Colorado's like state income tax, let's say, is like 8%. If you pay a Colorado-based employee, you know, maybe income tax for an employee in Colorado might be like 30%. Let's go as a baseline. So in total, you put those numbers together, maybe that's like 35% that the company plus the employee are paying in taxes. Again, rough math. Sweden, on the other hand, that base tax rate is going to be probably around 30% as well. But very quickly into a higher income bracket, you end up hitting the max tax threshold, which goes up to about 52% for you as an employee. On top of that, though, you also have the employer paying about 3x higher tax rate. So ballpark, it's like 25% taxes that the employer pays. So base income level, you're paying, if you account for the employer and the employee, like pretty close to a 50% tax rate. US, again, you know, it's like 35% that the employer plus employee are paying for every dollar that's paid out. So I look at it as way higher taxes, but at the end of the day, there's way more benefits that come with that. The other little just example I'll mention in here as well, because this blew my mind when I encountered this. Back in 2021, my wife took a, she's, for context, she's totally okay now, but she took a bad fall when we were rock climbing together. She ended up dislocating her arm. So we had to take her to the hospital, you know, went in for x-rays, got pain medications, everything of the sort. And then we were out of the hospital. She showed me the bill going out of the hospital, and it was like around $100 US.
Oh my God. Pay.
So wow. For Americans, you know, that's like, that's unheard of. When my son was born, the total bill, I think same thing. It was like around $100 that we ended up having to pay. So you pay a lot more in taxes over here, like significantly more in taxes, but you get so much back for all the taxes that you end up paying. So that's really shifted my viewpoint in favor of a lot of those systems. There's downsides to them. There's definitely opportunity for exploitation in these systems. But as a net, I see these as so good for society. I'd love to see more Americans study abroad in Scandinavian nations. A lot of Scandinavian nations tend to have these same general social safety nets. And I'd love to see the US start looking into these options more and more. I think it would be really good for the average American. Yeah, so that's absolutely. One really
GoFundMe
big
thing. Is not a healthcare strategy, right? It's not a, you know, if you get into a jam. And the interesting thing about those, you know, the countries people will talk about, the business opportunity growth in the United States, right? We've got these $1 trillion plus companies and a lot of them. And if you look at the growth over the years, it's been tremendous from a business growth standpoint, but the quality of life metric for Scandinavian countries is significantly higher. So it's like, everything is about balance really, right? It's do you want money in itself? And that's great, but do you want happy people and a happy society? And it sounds like that's what you found over there. And the data is, I mean, it's very clear on the subject. Not to, again, get into politics or whatever, but if you look at the declining birth rates across the world right now, right? Like it's a major problem. It's a major problem in the US. A lot of the Eastern countries, it's a major problem right now. And then you talked about like childcare, right? And the cost to have a child and then to obviously raise it. And my sister, when she was starting off, she was paying basically her entire salary towards child care for her kids, you know, early on in the beginning. I say that's not really good incentive to want to raise a family. You know what I mean? And I hear from people time and time again, they said, look, we're single. We like kids. We like being around them. We still want to enjoy life. We don't want to be struggling our entire life. And that's really their prime motivation for it. So I think there is a major motivating factor for countries to incentivize people to have kids by helping them make it more affordable. On the subject of work-life balance, I want to kind of talk a little bit about this because you're a dad, you're a father, you're running a growing agency. And then you also have, you're US focused, right? So you've got a lot of US clients over here, but you live internationally and you have a lot going on. I mean, how do you manage your work-life balance in this type of situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. So what I would say I've I approached it from a couple different angles over time. You know, one of the general mindsets I had is that my 20s was my time for myself. My 30s was going to be my time for my family. And that was a general plan I put into play probably when I was like 21, 22, maybe. So I was pretty selfish about really focusing on building my business when I was in my 20s. I'm 32 right now. So when I was like, call it like 30, 30 and a half, I think is when my wife got pregnant. Right around that time. 31, I become a dad. You know, 32, I'm a year into being a dad. With that, my number one focus right now is trying to figure out, hey, how can I, A, provide financial stability for my family along with my wife? But two, how can I be a really great role model for my son? How can I be a really great husband? So now I'm entering the phase where I'm trying to figure out, how do I step off the gas a little bit work-wise without having anything in the company suffer so that I can be more present in my home life? One of the tactics I've found really effective is I tend to work best in more so bursts of focus. So I find it really effective to have one day where I'll work 12 hours. Maybe I start working a little bit earlier in the day, I work a bit later in night, and then having a couple days a week that maybe I'm only working a half day, or maybe I'm working even less than that. I get to spend the entire day hanging out with my son. I'm still trying to figure out the perfect balance of that system, but what I've found really effective so far, especially given the time difference and given the fact that, call it 5 p.m. my time is 9 a.m. Denver time, or 3 p.m. my time is going to be 9 a.m. Eastern time, I have to take a lot of meetings towards the end of the day. So first half of the day really becomes the time that I get to spend with family. The thing I'm building on top of that is trying my best to take off Fridays entirely, pull my son out of daycare, and just get to spend the day hanging out with him until my wife gets home. So a couple of those elements coming together. Second half of the day, it's not very common that I get to put my son to bed like Monday through Thursday. But because of the time zone difference, I can have a pretty leisurely first half of the day, spend the day hanging out with my son, go rock climbing in the morning, get that health element coming into play. And then from there, I can go to the office. I can work until 9 p.m., 10 p.m. if needed, you know, later in extreme cases if needed. But having that balance where I say, hey, first half of the day, more or less, I'm not working. That's family time. Second half of the day, I'm really going to dive into work with almost no distractions, to the point where friends will tell you that they'll see like a 12-hour dead zone where you cannot reach me via text because I'm just not paying attention to my phone. That became problematic when my wife was, let's say, 8 months pregnant, and she pointed out, Pat, you're not responding to my texts. Like, you got to shift this ASAP, because if I go into labor, you need to be home in 20 minutes. But now we're beyond that phase. Now I think I'm okay to go back to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I love hearing about that. You know, a lot of people, it's not that you're not busy, but you're intentional with your time, right? You're very focused on that. And the same in my life as well. It's, you know, I got a lot going on, but when I am with my family, I'm very intentional around not being distracted by the other things that could get in the way. So I want to shift to talking a little bit about your business. So I'd like to hear about how your specialization in meta ads evolved alongside the SEO focus, and kind of how these two disciplines complement each other in your growth strategy.
Oh, definitely. Great question. So Meta Ads is the newest offering that we started rolling out 6 months ago, let's call it. Where that really came from, though, is call it back in 2016 when we started our business. The economy was really hot. SEO, candidly, was really easy to sell as a service because every business under the sun said, oh, the economy is doing great. We want to invest in the long term. This is the way to scale. As time went on, a couple things happened. One, I realized that most businesses, I would argue, that are doing less than probably $1 million in annual revenue, unless they're VC backed, should not be investing in SEO. I would say 9 out of 10 businesses, that's a bad starting investment. You're going to be far better off investing in some sort of paid channel until you reach about $1 million annual revenue. At that point, you can start thinking about those longer term growth strategies. Happy to dive deeper into that one in a sec here, but that's a starting point. Is I don't genuinely believe that SEO is right for most businesses doing less than $1 million in annual revenue. So for me to go out and sell that service to a lot of the businesses we're trying to help, like our big focus is businesses doing 2 to 20 million annual revenue. So businesses that are on like a little bit earlier stage than that, if I can't honestly say to them, hey, invest in this service, then it's really, I'm just not going to sell it to someone. So one, we had a lot of businesses that were coming to us that weren't at 2 million, but they were at $500,000 or maybe $1 million annual revenue. They were saying, hey, we want to work together. How do we get more customers? And I realized that, hey, I can't in good faith sell them SEO services. I can put them in touch with other people that offer these services, but I'd way rather have our team internally become experts at this so that we can directly help these businesses reach the next stage and eventually in the long term, help them out with SEO as well. Second thing, though, that came into play is past couple of years, the economy shifted. SEO has been, I would argue, a little bit harder to provide as a service because it's just not in as high of demand right now. So that's a big part of building the business is realizing it's not just about the micro environment. It's not about the micro economy at all times. You do have to look at some of the macro factors that are coming into play and understand how can you build a business that I would argue does really well in a booming economy, but also does really well in a recession or does really well in even just like a flat economy. Right now, I'd argue that customer sentiment, especially in the e-commerce space where we focus really heavily, is not the most optimistic. There's a lot of businesses that, especially due to tariffs, are really unsure about what the next 6 to 12 months hold for their e-com brand. So for them to invest in SEO, which is a long-term play, again, not always going to be the best investment. There's going to be some short-term wins we can roll out, but I'd way rather focus on some of those short-term wins with other services that are going to be way more impactful and then eventually talk to them about those longer-term growth strategies.
Yeah. So with the SEO, how is it being affected right now with the LLMs out there and AI? How's that affecting SEO right now?
So it's interesting. I would argue it's affecting SEO on two fronts. There's one, how does it affect business sentiment? And then two, how does it impact actual revenue or actual consumer impact? The most recent data I've seen is that Google drives, I've seen different reports, but I've seen numbers on the low end of 200x. On the high end, I've seen 370x. But Google drives somewhere between 200 and 370x more traffic to websites than ChatGPT does. And that Google has 200 to 370x more searches coming to their platform every month than ChatGPT does. The most recent data I've seen is that ChatGPT is like in line with ask.com, which is a pretty minor search engine, like less than 1% market share, and call it that broad information discovery space. LLMs are really popular. They're growing really quickly, but they still represent a really small part of the market. So what I'm seeing in every single Google Analytics account that I'm looking in, LLMs are growing at a really fast rate. So businesses are scaling very, very quickly, the visitors and the revenue they're getting from LLMs, but it's still such a small sliver of their overall business. And I'd argue it's such a small sliver of the overall economy. Now, that being said, there's a lot of excitement about it because it's this brand new emerging market, right? So it's this brand new shiny object that people can focus on. It's a totally untapped market. And I would argue in the next 5 to 10 years, I think it's going to boom. And I think it's going to continue to grow. And it's going to become a really big part of every business strategy. My take, though, is if you're a growing business and you're spending, call it less than $20,000, maybe less than $40,000 a month on marketing, investing in LLMs is probably not your best use of resources today. What I'd argue is way more effective is find a really effective paid channel for different businesses and different industries. There's going to be different recommendations I offer, but good blanket statement, start out with either Google ads or start out with Meta ads. Those are going to be really the two big players in the paid space. One of those two channels is most likely going to be really profitable for other businesses in your industry. Look at what those businesses are doing and look to replicate the things that work really well for them. So one, find a really effective paid channel. Two, as you start growing that paid channel, funnel some of the profits from it over to a long-term growth strategy like SEO, content marketing, you name it. from there, if you have leftover budget after you've accounted for some of the other elements that are going to be really important for once you've acquired that customer, getting them to buy from you again and again and again in the future. So after you've thought about SMS, after you've thought about email and some of these other retention strategies, certainly talk to Phil about this with TechStrip, great opportunity on the retention front. But after you've thought about, call it paid channel, long-term SEO channel, and retention, that is when I see LLMs being a really good focal point. One of the other data points I like to mention in here as well, though, and this is a limited data set from like 8 to 10 months ago, but most recent study I've seen is that there is a like 58% overlap between the businesses that are cited in ChatGPT and the businesses that are cited in the top 10 results of Google. That percentage goes up to closer to 70% if you look at ChatGPT compared to Bing, which certainly there's a very close relationship between the Microsoft company that owns Bing and OpenAI as a whole, which certainly owns ChatGPT. My takeaways from that, if you optimize around SEO, you're already getting yourself, call it like 50 to 70% of the way there, just right out of the gate. LLMs are looking at a lot of the same data sets that SEOs and that search engines are in order to determine when to feature one business over another in their prompt responses that they're putting out. Rambling aside, I see LLMs as a huge opportunity. It's something that really excites me personally, so I spend probably more time on it than I should right now. But right now, the market opportunity at this exact moment, I would argue, is nowhere near as high as most people perceive it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So going along the lines with the LLMs, a lot of tools and a lot of people putting out all these blog articles and LinkedIn articles and things like that that are solely written with AI. How's that affecting the market? And do you have any advice for somebody who's, you know, maybe picked up one of those tools and is just building up this blog site on a WordPress with all of this this LLM content?
Yeah, great question. And I was going to say, and I'll, Phil, if you're cool with it, I can mention an article that gives my full deep dive into how I think you should answer the question of, should I use AI tools in order to create content for my blog? And I'll share it afterwards. It's a blog article we wrote earlier this year. But really high level, I look at it as creating content with large language models. There's really two approaches you can take. One, if you're going to use AI tools to create blog content, I absolutely understand the appeal. It's cutting the cost of producing a piece of content, whether it's video, whether it's written content, I would argue by like probably 99%. Let's work with that as a rough number. You're more or less making that content rounding down to being free. There is going to be a whole slew of businesses in your individual industry for the listener that are going to take that exact approach. And there's an argument to be made that that is a smart move because you're more or less getting a bunch of content for free. It becomes a volume game. I understand that overarching appeal. If you're choosing to take that route, understand that in the long term, you're providing zero competitive advantage over your competitor that can create that exact same blog article using those exact same tools and that exact same tone. I would argue you're entering a race to the bottom if you choose to take that route. And there is pennies to be made in a race to the bottom, but you're putting yourself in a market where there's no long-term competitive advantage. There's nothing that I would argue separates you from every other brand out there that's doing the exact same thing. And then long-term, you also run into an issue that you're going to alienate your customers, that you're potentially going to get on the bad side of search engines, which we've seen a lot of data points indicating that they, I don't want to directly say that they are penalizing sites that use AI because that it's way too nuanced of a statement, but I would argue that spitting out a bunch of content with AI tools creates a really high risk that search engines are going to perceive your website as having low quality content, which can lead to your traffic dropping significantly if you see a lot of value from search today. So one, if you want to take that route, I would argue that is best suited for the businesses that more so have a short-term approach in mind. If you're building a content site today and your plan is that you want to make it profitable as soon as possible, and within the next 3 years, you're okay if that site crashes and burns, you'll build up a new one. I think that AI can actually be a really good approach for that. It's a really great way to scale your content. It can also, for those early stage brands, be a really great proof of concept tool. If you decide to roll out 100 different blog articles, see if any of them gain traction, and then you choose to manually rewrite the ones that do gain traction, that can be a really effective way to test a lot of different small data points, see what starts to, like, throwing a bunch of paint against the wall, seeing what sticks, and then deciding to invest more heavily from there. I would argue, on the other hand, though, that there's going to be that second group of brands. These are mainly the brands that we work with, and those are the brands that see their brand as an asset to their business. They're the companies that look at their content as an opportunity to really closely connect with their customers. They see it as an opportunity to, based on their subject matter experience, provide information that their customers are looking for on a regular basis and provide it in a way that reflects what makes their brand truly unique, to add that human element in there. I've yet to see a really good case of LLMs being able to truly replicate brand voice. Maybe we reach that point at some point. I'm a little more skeptical of that side of things coming into play in the near future. But for that second group of brands that are willing to invest in that, call it that manual process of creating content with humans, maybe relying on AI to help with some of the heavy lifting process, whether it be topic ideation, whether it be getting feedback on their first draft of their outline, whether it be getting ideas to talk about within their outline, I see those as really great use cases. But as soon as you entirely remove that human element from the equation and you remove that opportunity for that subject matter expert on your team, who, let's say, has a decade of experience working with your customers, understands their pain points, as soon as you remove that from the equation, I'd argue you're kind of kneecapping yourself in terms of what is the value of the content we're putting out versus every other brand that's out there. So, wrapping it all together, either enter the race to the bottom, expect that you're entering a volume game and that you're going to be earning pennies on the dollar, but it is going to be much more cost effective in the short term. I'd argue really great approach for the really new brands or the brands that have a much shorter term life cycle for their business. Or group two, differentiate yourself, invest way more heavily in content than your competitors, because you know that you're giving yourself an unfair advantage if your subject matter expert sits down and writes a 2,000 word blog article that is then going to be competing in rankings against your five competitors that have AI generated blog content.
Yeah. And had an example. I met this guy at a conference who had a bunch of these blog sites that were AI generated. And early on with OpenAI, he was making bank on ads. He was running on them and all that kind of stuff. And he was devastated at this conference because overnight the Google algorithm changed and destroyed his entire business, completely destroyed it. And he, you know, early on was like, hey, I got this thing figured out. I just sit back, the AI generates the content and I'm good. Somewhere along the way, Google said, wait a minute, we can't keep plugging this regurgitated content back into our system. And it completely annihilated his business. So that's always been my concern on it as well. And I agree with you. AI is a great tool. Don't get lazy with it. Use it, but keep your individuality in there as well.
Absolutely. And Phil, just building upon that, and I'm going to keep this a little bit vague. I didn't sign an NDA with this brand, but just want to be respectful of the fact that they went through a really tough time because of this scenario. I'm going to say within the past 12 to 18 months, we had a larger brand reach out to us. Ballpark, they were seeing 25, 30 million people coming to their site every month from search engines like Google. So very well established business. They reached out to us because overnight they more or less saw their organic search traffic go down to zero. I'm going to round and say more or less every page on their site was removed from Google's index. And the big reason for it is they receive what's called a manual action from Google, where ultimately a member of Google's web spam team looked at their site, flagged it in the backend system, and ultimately said, hey, this goes against one of our rules. Specifically for them, it was this broad theme called thin content, which is a polite way of Google saying, hey, we think the content on your website is trash. Whether it's true or not, that's Google politely saying, we think your website content is trash.
Like you just basically tossed some keywords in there trying to get the content that you want, but there's nothing that's actually substantial that people want to be to your site to learn about those keywords, right? Exactly. Is that kind of an overview of it, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And with it, you know, really, it was pretty obvious if you look at the content on the site, like, was pretty obviously AI generated. But again, that's just anecdotal. That's one specific case that I just experienced firsthand when that brand reached out to us afterwards. But it goes to show, you know, if you're working with AI, there are risks that come into play. You're, especially if you have an established business, I'd argue you potentially are losing a lot, with the potential upside being that you're just going to reduce cost of content production a little bit.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. So, all right. So thank you so much, Pat. And for those who want to learn more about your journey and insights, where can they find additional information about you and your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say two biggest places that I'm going to be most active online are going to be LinkedIn and now Instagram more recently. Outside of that, though, if you want to check out my insights, go to the Intergrowth blog, intergrowth.com/blog. I write typically an article a month, article every 2 months, all about customer acquisition for the long term, the things that we're seeing in the space. Other things I will say is, specifically if you're in the e-commerce space, check out our podcast, Customer Growth Sessions. Whole focus of it is talking about the unsexy parts of scaling an e-commerce business. And actually, we just had Phil on a couple weeks ago. Our episode went live a few days back on November 12th. Phil gave an awesome overview talking about retention marketing, specifically through TechStrip. So if you're working in e-commerce, check out Phil's episode, subscribe to Customer Growth Sessions. We got a lot of good stuff on there.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Pat. And thank you to our audience for listening today. And I'm Phil Portman, reminding you to stay focused, stay confident, and keep defining success on your own terms. Until next time.